Hey everybody, we're back with another Commission podcast. I know why you're here listening today, because we got a great podcast for you. Freddie C. commissioning the 1995.
You see that stuff coming out of the listeners' ears? They can't hear yet.
So take it easy, Slick. He commissioned the great Michael Mann's Heat, 1995 Heat, starring Al Pacino and Robert De Niro.
Keep going.
Val Kilmer.
Keep going.
John Voight.
Yep. You haven't even reached, like, the third.
Amy Brenneman. Ashley Judd.
I wrote them all
Tom
down.
Sizemore. I'm just real off the top of my head.
Michael T. Williamson.
Michael T.
William Fichtner.
Danny Trejo.
Yeah, Danny Trejo, who plays, funnily enough, a character named Trejo in this movie.
That has to be, because he was just like a working stiff stuntman at this phase in his career, wasn't
he? He was not Machete yet.
Right. Rodriguez hadn't rediscovered him.
Natalie Portman.
Natalie fucking Portman. You've seen this movie before, yes?
No.
I realized
somewhere through watching this movie that I had never watched this movie.
Oh, wow. Because I think I've seen this movie maybe 3 or 4 times. It's been probably 10 years since I've seen it, and that's the perfect amount of time, because I knew like who lives and who dies, but how that happened was a complete mystery. And it's just, I found this movie a lot of fun to watch. What did you think, since this is your first time through?
I wish I had seen this movie contemporary to its release. Because I think I would have liked it more. Not to say I didn't like it. I thought it was a very well-constructed heist movie for the 90s. But I do feel like I would have liked it more back then.
What holds you back? Because I will say that seeing it with another 10 or 15 years of miles on my odometer, I appreciate some of the stuff a lot differently. Like, there's a lot less admiration for
the
main characters, and a lot more like, this is really deeply fucked up stuff.
Right. That's the thing that I think kept me from enjoying it, is the fact that they're essentially glorifying this cops and robbers ideal. And I don't personally think that's something to aspire to, but
right.
The movie kind of, in some ways, makes it aspirational. In some ways, it doesn't. Like,
well, it's weird because, like, I don't think anyone watches this movie and then wants to engage in a shootout with the cops. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like some of the other stuff that, like, when Robert De Niro says, "You never have an attachment to something you can't leave in 30 seconds when you see," I feel like it's weird in that, like, there are people who watch this and think, yeah, that's the way to go.
Right.
Like, that's...
Like Scarface, right? Like,
right.
Plenty of people take their life lessons from the movie Scarface. And I'm
right.
like, that's... You realize that's a tragedy. Like, the whole character there is set up to make you not want to be him, right?
No, and then, like, the fact that this movie is very Shakespearean and, like, heightened, almost romantic at the end. Like, that final scene is like a Renaissance painting.
Yeah, where they grab hands. And,
and it's very... it's very bromance. Like, the love affair in this relationship is between... It's actually between Pacino and De Niro's work in themselves, or themselves in themselves, or each other.
Yeah.
Like, the attachments they feel towards the women in their life seem like they're very surface level and possession oriented. But holy shit, super interesting. Like,
you
can watch it with your head firmly up your ass, and it's the greatest thing ever. And you can also watch it like, wow, this is some deeply troubled, like, real-life Batman who are psychotic going out and doing things in the world, and it's still kind of entertaining because...
It is. It's excellently plotted.
I can't believe how many cat-and-mouse games are pulled off. Like, if you'd asked me how many reversals in this movie, I would have said in the beginning, like, I think there's 3 or 4. There's, like, 10. And they stuff, like, a last-minute Natalie Portman slitting her wrist and femoral artery plot and, like... the middle of the grand climax of the film, and it never feels like overstuffed. It all feels very, very effortless.
Well, it is given time to breathe, and I mean screen time, because it's a 3-hour movie.
Right. And also, like, I feel like the John Voight's character exists solely to move the plot along in places.
Yeah.
Like, there's this character who, by all rights, should either be arrested or whacked by, like either the good guys should arrest him or the bad guys should whack him. He knows too much. He plays both sides. He's too deeply connected. He's profiting off all of it. Mm-hmm. But he's able to just float and be the intermediary between the police and the cops and to pass information this way and that, and they arrange fences, and he knows everybody. And But you don't really notice that the first couple times, like how much he is essentially a plot device.
Yeah, no, that's true. But he is expertly playing that game, right? There's a version of the game here to be played, which is like walking the tightrope between getting arrested and killed, mm-hmm. and succeeding in pleasing the cops and the criminals enough that neither of them want to take you out. And John Voight in this movie is doing an excellent job of it. Unlike, I don't remember his name, the guy who hooks Al Pacino up with Tone Loc. He seems like he's playing the game much less effectively.
Yeah, in fact, like, that's an odd beat in the movie, because at the end of that scene, I'm like, well, Pacino just got played by this guy. Mm-hmm. Like, he huffed and he puffed, but he doesn't, you know, for whatever reason, he's not going to blow the guy's house down. That guy knows it, and then this is a dead end. To my surprise, 45 minutes later, Tone Loc is in the club talking a bunch of shit. Yeah. Like, I mean, so how many Michael Mann movies have you seen? Have you seen Last of the Mohicans?
I honestly don't know. No,
I'm
going to
trail off
that.
The ones I've seen. Last of the Mohicans, The Insider. That's the one
I don't think I've seen that. Val Kilmer, right?
No, it's the Australian guy who fights around the world.
Russell Crowe?
Russell Crowe as the cigarette guy.
Okay.
Collateral, which has Tom Cruise and Jamie Lee Foxx.
I just typed Val Kilmer into IMDb, and Val Kilmer came up, so...
They speak your language. Yeah. Ali, and then, of course, Heat. And it seems like that his thing is to make films around these unconventional badass heroes.
Okay.
You know, yeah. That have, like, almost a supernatural skill set. And make it look really, really stylistic and slick and cool. And like a fetishistic insistence upon accuracy and like gunplay and fighting and things of that nature. Which I think is cool. Like, you know, there's several shootouts in this film, but the climactic one where they're in their suits and they're robbing the bank for $12 million is one of the finest action sequences I've seen in film. And, it's the first time I've seen it in a good surround setup, because I've got, like, that Sonos system that the Sonos people gave to us. And it's a real treat to hear, like, all of that on screen.
Yeah, I mean, between the gunfights and the helicopters and, like, all the... It is an audio spectacle.
Yeah, like when, and they're fighting from both sides. So Val Kilmer's like unloading, and then he has to whip around, and you can like it's a real sonic treat. It's a real workout for your 5.5.1 system.
I think so. He did Ali, right?
Yes.
Did he write and direct that? I think
I believe so.
He did. That's
the other thing. Like that, he's this triple threat: writer, director, producer, and he's really like, I think, as much as the action scenes is good in this film, the dialogue, even when it's like hyper-masculine bullshit, is really good hyper-masculine bullshit.
It is. It's tight, too. It doesn't feel like I'm ever waiting for them to get to the point. Which is something I love about most, like, crime movies.
Right.
These guys do not really fuck around with words.
Right.
And they typically say what they mean, and they do what they say, and I don't know. I like that.
But no, I like the dialogue and how punchy it is, and how, like, I put it up there with like Glengarry Glen Ross as far as absorbing scenes, watching people act. And I think this is the one and only time in film where De Niro and Pacino actually sit across from each other and act.
Oh yeah,
I think it's the first time like they shared the screen in Godfather, but because of the conceit of the movie, Robert De Niro plays the young Vito Corleone and Pacino plays Michael. They never actually meet on camera. There might be a weird camera dissolve where they briefly are on the screen for the same frame or two, but like, and I want to talk about that scene because One of the things that originally convinced me, or I got the idea to start doing television and film podcasting, was an extended sequence where, like, Bill Simmons, back in the day, had a bunch of guests to talk about movies, and one of the things he liked to debate is, like, who won the scene, like a heavyweight, and he did the sequence of, with Pacino and De Niro, and it was so absorbing to hear these guys break down the scene and, like, who won it.
Let me guess, who won? According to them.
I don't remember.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind. Personally, I think De Niro wins this scene.
Holy shit. I thought, yeah. Okay. Because my opinion.
I think De Niro is the more intimidating force here.
Okay. I think Pacino is written to win the scene, and he does, in fact, win the scene.
Huh.
Because it's a pretty even score, but the crucial scene is at the end, where they both say, they're like, well, you know, essentially...
Yeah, me against the corner, I got you.
Or what if it's me and I see you first and yeah. She'd blow you away? De Niro breaks the eye contact first. Hmm. And as soon as he looks away, Pacino's got a kind of just like a little smile. Like it's a millimeter, the corners of his mouth. Like, you know, like I'm going to kill you and we both know it. And that's what happens in the film. Now,
it's weird to me because
who won from a crafts perspective is a lot more fascinating because they're both swinging for defenses.
Well,
and restrained swinging for defenses.
There, okay, yeah, that's fair because I like they're swinging for the fences, and then there's this scene, and I feel like Robert De Niro, just in my mind as a gangster, as a heist, like a criminal. Has more gravitas in this scene than Al Pacino, who I've seen... Look, I've seen Robert De Niro in some really shitty movies.
Sure.
As of late, he's done nothing but crap for all I care.
Right.
But Al Pacino has been in some movies that should be really awesome, and he has made them feel less than awesome with his acting.
Right.
I don't know when... I think it might have been Scent of a Woman when Al Pacino started to say, you know what my acting style is? It's just to shout randomly at the camera.
Right.
And, like, to me, that just almost makes me laugh instead of, like, take him more seriously. Whereas
right.
De Niro has, like a quiet kind of something under the surface, like very quiet and stoic and just, like, at any moment he could, like, bust out and just kill
you. Totally.
Whereas Pacino, I feel like he's going to shout and bluster and then it's... not going to be that intimidating in the end.
But, you know, I agree with that. And one of the central points that the movie makes, and John Voight bangs this home, is like, look, in a fight with this guy can miss and miss and miss.
Sure.
And only needs
yeah.
to hit once. You have to hit every single time. And I think that you're right. Pacino is a more bigger, less controlled, like, I read something that made me laugh hysterically as an interview with him in 2016. He's like, oh, by the way, you're supposed to understand my character is on cocaine 100% of the time.
Oh,
I'm like, oh.
His character.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We got that. we definitely fucking got that.
We know that somebody was on cocaine the whole time.
But he's a less tight and controlled and broader and sloppier performance where De Niro's not because it has to be. And then it beautifully sets up the moment where you see, like, as soon as De Niro whips off to get to the highway to go to that hotel to kill what's-his-fake, Mullet Man.
Yeah.
He's done fucked up. This is where he doesn't. This is where he won. He won. Uh-huh. All he had to do was allow...
Just leave.
Admittedly, a sleazeball monster to walk the earth, and he could be off in New Zealand with Amy Brenneman in her fucking prime.
Uh-huh.
And he can't do it. He can't do it.
No, he can't. But here's the thing. So I would give you that, and I would say, okay, that is an intentional thing that the movie is trying to do, if it weren't for the fact that Al Pacino does this in, like, every movie he's in. He is sloppier in his acting. He is, like, bigger and broader and less controlled than Robert De Niro in every role he's in, except for maybe The Godfather.
I mean, there's other ones that he's certainly... been able to reel it back. But yeah, I do think that around The Godfather 2, during the abortion scene, some fuse broke in his brain, and he's like, whoa, man, look what the fuck happened there. I can do that at any time.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, if you maintain this icy mass that allows, like, the volcanic fury to get out, like, once every 6 hours of cinema, that's powerful.
Yeah.
If you do it every 15 minutes, it's a person with a medical condition that needs to be treated.
Right.
But I felt like that this police role is like the William Dafoe role in Boondock Saints. It's like the Gary Oldman role in Leon the Professional. Like, there is this archetype of crime scene investigator brilliance. This is Matthew McConaughey in season one of True Detective that you can, and maybe Michael Mann knows that and why it's so smart to cast Pacino, is that this world is designed to have like a impulsive, compulsive, addictive, big personality in it, and that can be fine in contrast to, you know, De Niro's button-down menace.
Where those big characters get drug in and arrested.
Yeah. It's also funny how De Niro, because I was comparing his performance here to his performance in Jackie Brown. In Jackie Brown, he kind of plays a sloppy fuck-up.
Uh-huh.
But it's a completely different sloppy kind of fuck-up than Pacino plays.
Sure. It never devolves to shouting at the camera.
Didn't like Pacino's performance in here?
You know what? I don't think I like Pacino's performance in a lot of stuff he's in.
That's completely fair.
I like him in Glengarry Glen Ross. I like him in the Godfather stuff.
Right.
I like him in fucking... What's the Attica movie?
I haven't seen that one.
Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of that stuff is older.
But this movie, you didn't think it worked?
Everything except where he starts screaming and yelling. He just gets over the top, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, when he talks about the great ass, I'm like, that line could have been really good, but you made me laugh. You made me laugh, and I was not supposed to laugh in this scene.
Aren't you? Because he also has this other scene earlier on where he's rolling tough on Tone, the Tone Loafs.
Yeah.
But when he's like, I need you to give me all you got. Give me all you got. Give me all you got! And I don't know, I felt like...
I feel like that was the 15th take, and he was just over it. And Michael Mann keeps saying, no, one more, Al. And that time
so
he came
Mann
in and he just started shouting.
He wants him to unleash the beast.
Maybe so, I just can't help but laugh when he does.
But, you know, without that... Is there a fucking funny thing in this movie? Like, could this movie be 3 hours long with nothing funny in it?
Maybe not. Maybe not.
Yeah, I don't know. Because I found myself really liking it, and it really hammered home. Because he's... I think it's interesting to see, like, Pacino's bullshit. His character's bullshit. Like, when he's explained to his wife, like, hey, baby, this is the life you chose. And... You know, kind of like you're living in denial, or maybe it's not denial, but it's more of like, I mean, I don't know. It seems like these guys, my criticism of these types of guys is there's some, I think, professions and careers that you just shouldn't be in a relationship with if you want to be him and do him to your fullest. Like,
and both of the main characters in this are in that camp.
Yeah, like this is just a sacrifice that you need to make. I'm not saying you got to stay away from women. Mm-hmm. I'm saying you can't get in a relationship with the person and have kids because you're just setting yourself up to be a bad husband and bad father.
Yeah.
And even
if you can walk away from that in 30 seconds,
right?
That's fucked up.
Yeah. No. I mean, so the other thing is like, but maybe. Maybe they need like it's one of those things where I don't know, because there's this one scene where I felt like it's peak Pacino's character bullshit, where he's like, what do you want me to say, baby? You want me to come home and be like, yeah, there's a junkie zap fried a baby in a microwave because it wouldn't stop screaming. I'm supposed to just share that with you and it somehow dispels all of it. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, that's how it fucking works, man. You talk about these things, you get them out inside, you share them with other human beings, and it does let the little poison. But then he just continues on and says, but I need to keep that inside of me, because that's what keeps me sharp, that's what keeps me going. Is that true?
Yeah, maybe.
Because honestly, some of this shit is so extreme. Like, if you're a major crimes unit investigator, you are gazing into the abyss.
Yeah.
And... is inevitable the abyss gazes back. Like, I mean, I'm not going to be sitting there as like my cushy job as a podcaster and my extremely demanding job as a guy punching keys on a keyboard before that and say like, ah, fucking bullshit. All he needs is a drum circle and kumbaya. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's why these films still kind of work, because I would never want to be that unhealthy of a person, but the extremes of the human experience are kind of fascinating to watch.
Yeah. I think the tragedy of all of this is you wouldn't need guys like Pacino if there weren't guys like De Niro and vice versa, right? Like, they're driving each other.
Right.
That's the nature of cops and robbers. And I don't know. I mean, to me, it's like, why can't everybody just say, okay, this is all crazy, let's not do it. But
well,
they're sure. compelled to for various reasons.
Because it's like the prisoner's dilemma, right? You know, the most beneficial game theory state is for everyone to cooperate. Yeah. But if one cooperates and one collaborates, the cooperator gets fucked.
Yeah.
So everyone everyone does the antagonistic option because that limits your
and that levels the playing field.
That's the criminal underworld in a nutshell. Like, right. Always suspect the other guy's going to fuck you and you'll never be fucked and you'll do the majority of the fucking. Mm-hmm. Because there is no rule of law. It's capitalism and social Darwinism at its most basic.
Mm-hmm. Here's the other disturbing thing about Al Pacino in this movie. I never in my life again want to see Al Pacino making love.
I agree. I have that. My first notes on my notepad are Pacino fucking. I've seen this man devour a 16-year-old in The Godfather.
God.
And crawl inside a woman's skin in this film with his mouth and like weird.
Just all his parts. None of it is.
I'm done. I'm done. Yeah. My odometer says 2. At 3, my engine explodes. Like I can't do it, man.
No, it's too much. And then they go directly from that to a Pacino shower scene, and I'm like, nope. That is the extent.
Take the shower now. I feel like there's no amount of scrubbing is going to get me clean.
Fortunately, it's followed up by a really solid heist.
Sure,
like a very good, competently executed heist, except for the wild card of Wayne Grew.
Right. Before we get into that, I want to talk about, because I still got more to say about Pacino and De Niro.
Okay.
This movie, there was like a 5-year window that this movie could have been made starring these men because they were the perfect age for it. Like, these characters are written to be guys who are slightly past their prime but can still bring it. You can see, like, there's a couple, like, I was really impressed with the physicality of these middle-aged men's performance. Like, there's a scene where Pacino is just hauling ass Tom Cruise style with an M16 across this airport tarmac to keep up with De Niro. And, like, he is really fucking running. Like, yeah. I feel like he probably couldn't move for a week after that scene.
And he doesn't have the long legs of De Niro.
Right.
De Niro's got height on him.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like 5 years from there, they couldn't have believably, like, okay, he's summoning all of his, like, whatever and into this one last chase. Like, they'd be too old to believably care.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, if they were younger, it wouldn't have the impact of these guys over the hill. Like, it's kind of amazing that this film came together with these two men who are, like, these big storied roles, have these big storied roles in history in American crime films, and they're at the exact perfect age to tell the tale.
Yeah.
Did you know that this was based on a true story, by the way?
I didn't.
Like, down to the coffee conversation. It was something that happened in the 60s between a bank robber and I think it was an FBI agent. Maybe it was a LAPD crimes unit guy. Just like a lot of the cat and mouse, a lot of the details. I mean, obviously it was updated for the modern day technology and whatnot. But
down to the shootout?
Not the beats of the shootout, but like the fact that like two guys died, one guy got wounded and made off, one guy got killed later on. The Val Kilmer character is sent to prison. I think he's still in prison.
Huh.
The article I read on this was from 2011. That at that time he is still alive.
He didn't. He didn't drive away after they checked.
No, he didn't. Ashley Judd wasn't there to give him the brush off. And,
yeah.
So I guess I'm done talking about Pacino and De Niro, although when they first started the, like, planning scenes and the corresponding investigation scenes, I was worried that they would seem tedious because that has been copied. Like, the heist film has become a thing since now. But I felt like they still held up. Like, no matter how many times I've seen guys like Pacino and Tommy Lee Jones bark orders of seemingly nonsensical orders and have six dudes just instantly start complying, I don't know. It doesn't seem to get old.
Like, no, and I thought it was quick enough. Like, it moved along. You know? They never, like, lingered on it like an Ocean's movie would.
And they didn't do a lot of explaining what happened. Like, you know, you usually find out how bad the bad guys are fucked in real time with the bad guys. And mm-hmm. You discover along the police that they've been had or they've been thrown or they've been shook. And that kind of rhythm of that back and forth and the cleverness of it and the fact that you kind of have to put a little bit of that two and two together most of the time. There's a couple scenes where, like, Pacino at the docks where De Niro's taking pictures of him from, like, a crane that's apparently 5,000 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. That was the most kind of ham-fisted, like, oh, look what happened here. But I thought a lot of that stuff held up and wasn't tedious and still plays as clever.
So let me ask you about that scene. I feel like there's a huge mistake here made by Robert De Niro, made by Neil, because what he does here is so he's trying to fish out Al Pacino. Mm-hmm. He's trying to capture his tail and see who's following
Pacino.
Him. But he does it by essentially just going out to the docks and pointing in a direction randomly.
Right.
And hoping that he'll take the bait, and he does.
Uh-huh.
What if he had staged that at a place which had conceivable targets around? Pacino never gets on to him, right?
Yeah.
I feel like it's a huge miscalculation on De Niro's part.
I agree, but I was kind of in disbelief that De Niro quickly dismissed the container yard. Like, maybe he hasn't seen
in the
season two
yeah.
of The Wire, uh-huh. but an endless amount of fascinating things that could be stolen and are illegal and maybe even undocumented that only criminals could know would be in those container yards. And he's just like, it's just a yard full of metal containers we can't see into without warrants and are stacked six deep and a mile long. Couldn't possibly be a target. Like,
one of those has got to be filled with Furbies.
Yeah,
and you can eBay the shit out of those things in 95.
There's one full of heroin, and the other there's another full of like 17 Eastern European women for trafficking. Like, right. There is shit there, De Niro. Come on, Pacino. Come on.
Yeah, that was foolish. I felt like that was maybe the worst scene in the movie.
There's
honestly.
A couple of like, but I wonder if some of that stuff is like intentionally written in sloppy. Because the other thing I noticed is like. John Voight's character, who, my God, John Voight, he plays like an anthropomorphic sleazeball. He's an omniscient sleazeball. Like he just looks like a sleazeball. John Voight's puffy white.
They've done some makeup to him, I guess.
He's done some makeup and the ponytail. Everything about him is he's a sleazeball. But his fundamental analysis of the beginning of the fencing the first heist mm-hmm. is wrong and causes a lot of the carnage in the movie. Like him saying, like, hey, this guy's fully insured at this stuff. We can sell him back to him 60 cents on the dollar. He makes out, we make out.
It's a good plan.
And he's a businessman.
It's a really good plan. But William Fichtner doesn't go along with it.
He sees himself more as a gangster than a businessman, and he gets quickly disabused of the notion. But by then, it's already, you know, there's been a lot of shit has transpired.
Yeah, I feel like you pull this with, like, a Goldman Sachs dude, and he probably goes along with it because he sees the margin.
Yeah.
But, like, this guy is a money launderer. He's more connected to the criminal underworld than you might want, for a target. So,
well, there's a little bit of like, I mean, that's like a Elmore Leonard kind of move where you've got a criminal who, because of his life, so he's like a Wall Street guy who started to launder money and he thinks he's this big swinging dick.
Right.
But in reality, he's a shrinky dink in a 40-degree pool, and Robert De Niro is going to throw lawn furniture through his window and kill him.
Should have tried this with Christian Bale in The Big Short. Yeah. That would have worked.
But like, it's funny because John Voight fucks up that analysis, and there's not like I kind of expected some acrimony and maybe him to distrust some of the information he gets later, but like, I don't know. But again, I don't know whether I don't think that's a writing flaw. That's just like, this is an imperfect thing. You got to trust your gut, and sometimes your gut's wrong. Like, it builds into the thesis of you have to hit every single one of your hits. Like, speaking of The Wire, it's like, Avon Barksdale saying, you know, how are you never going to have a slow day? How are mm-hmm. you ever going to have a day where you don't get tripped up? How are you going to live every day perfectly? You can't. Like, that's the problem. Like, there eventually come a day where you fuck up that'll correspond to the police noticing, and then it's over.
Yep.
I don't know. I thought that that stuff was pretty cool.
That's why you got to get in, go big, and get out.
Right.
That's what you got to do. You got to steal the Mona Lisa.
did you... I thought it was interesting. Like, Val Kilmer is the most fucked up person. Well, maybe we can talk about Tom Sizemore here in a minute. Val Kilmer is the most fucked up guy in this movie, right?
I think so, yeah.
Because, like, I just thought it was incredible where he's, you know, Robert De Niro is talking to him about his relationship with Ashley Judd. And he's like, you got anything on the side? He's like, yeah, a little bit. Nothing serious. And he says, like, the sun rises and sets with her.
Mm-hmm.
But it clearly doesn't. Yeah. The sun rises and sets in a fucking Las Vegas casino, dude.
Mm-hmm.
This is why you're in the situation. Like, and then why does De Niro go to, like, I don't quite understand why De Niro loves Val Kilmer so much.
I don't know.
To see him as himself, like a younger version of himself, which that didn't seem. Mm-hmm. Does he see, like, you know, that he has a potential to be him if he gets his shit together? Like, I don't know.
I'm not sure. It might just be as simple as they've done a lot of jobs together.
Yeah. Because the crew's tight. We see that, like, that plays out in the scene where they're talking about doing the one last heist, and Tom Sizemore's character, like, clearly should not do this. And he's maybe the one that's got his life most together, it seemed like. And boy, goddamn, his exit from this film is pretty brutal. Like, Al Pacino shoots him out from underneath his baby girl.
It's easily the most dangerous stunt in the movie, because imagine if he just falls the other way. That poor girl will be crushed under Tom Sizemore.
I mean, yeah, he's trusting his aim. Yeah, it's insane. It's insane.
No, it is. But I at the same time, like, I kind of thought it was awesome.
No, totally. And it also fits in with this guy who's just coked up and on this adrenaline high that he's not going to think about. Like De Niro, I don't think, or I'm sorry, Pacino does not ever once in this movie contemplate that he can fail.
Mm-hmm. And if he does fail, he'll put it behind him and he'll keep going. And,
right. And someone else will pay the price.
It'll work for him.
Yeah, because he kind of lives his life by the same rules of, like, he doesn't really have anything in his life that he can't walk away from for more than 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, when his wife... I mean, how much analysis you want to do of his third wife and his relationship? Like, clearly they shouldn't be together. Yeah. I think there's better ways to exit a relationship, especially when you've got a troubled daughter in the mix, than to just bring home a man and fuck him on...
Mm-hmm.
But...
Especially Gregory.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's one of my favorite scenes.
She had to debase herself with Gregory.
that's hilarious. I love having this man being both berated,
he's a prop, yeah,
berated by Al Pacino, and told to sit down and shut up and get on that couch and watch this unfold.
Yeah,
and also her, like, talking about how demeaning it is to sleep with him, and, like, right to his face. It's so hilarious.
Yeah,
that was the best scene in the movie, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
So, let's see, what else we want to talk about? The Val Kilmer character. His arc is so weird because, like, I don't know why Ashley Judd loves this guy. I don't think Ashley Judd loves this guy. I don't know why Ashley Judd risks her. Why does she risk everything, including her child? Like, I thought that one of the best scenes is Michael T. Williamson laying it all out for her. He's like, You know, this guy chose his life. Your son didn't. Why would you risk all this for this guy? Yeah. Like, he made his decision. These are the consequences. And she's like, what are you selling? And he's like, oh, I'm selling all kinds of shit. But I don't need to sell this because it sells itself. That's exactly right. And I'd forgotten that she warns him off. And I was kind of flabbergasted as I watched it. I'm like, why the fuck?
That's such a reckless move. Yeah,
it is. And it doesn't. To me, that's a false note in the movie, because I don't think a real woman in that situation, who has already stepped out on him, who's already finding a way to get out of the car, who got bullied, frankly, by De Niro, which that's a volcanic scene. When he comes in there and slaps those hangers, one of them flies off and hits her right. And I kept on thinking, like, what happens if the hook gets into her eye?
Like, becomes a very different scene.
Yeah, there's a bunch of method acting, and it's very menacing, and it shows De Niro as, like, his scariest level, but, like, it's also kind of dangerous a performance. I don't know why, because it's not like she's ever going to see him again. He's gone.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It doesn't make a lot of sense from her perspective. And maybe it would have if they had set up that relationship a little bit more. If they had told us a little bit about why she was with him in the first place.
I mean, maybe we're supposed to understand that she's acting out in the same way Pacino's wife's acting out, as a desperate way to either get him to release her, so it's not, you know, like, I've been there. The good parts in a relationship are good enough that you don't really want to leave, but the bad parts are bad enough that you don't really want to stay. Yeah. You really wish the other person would just fucking make the decision. Are we going to live with this, or are we going to get out of it? I don't want to make the decision.
I do feel like a lot of this movie hinges on because she loves him. Like, there's a lot of stuff that isn't explained other than just, like, she just loves him, right?
I feel like the Amy Brenneman stuff works because she's clearly, like...
That works the best.
Because she's clearly young and naive, and it's like we're supposed to believe kind of socially awkward.
And a little bit desperate. Like,
and she gets the feeling like there's a lot of, like, emotional connection without her knowing anything about it. But then, you know, I mean, I read that as patently crazy, too, when he comes and says, go to New Zealand with me.
Sure.
I don't even know you.
Quit your job,
you know enough.
Give, like, up your life and
right.
And you don't essentially need, be my sidekick.
Like, you don't need money. I've got all the money you need. Like, okay, so I'm going to be financially independent with you in a country that I don't know. And I'm going to have any gainful employment to get away if I need to. Yes, this all seems... But it works because I think you're supposed to understand that Amy Brenneman's character is just fucking naive. And clearly Twitter-pated with Robert De Niro, who, you know, is a charismatic guy. I get that.
Yeah.
Also, Amy Brenneman, I thought she was so attractive in The Leftovers. I had, like, this big crush on her.
How about
but
20 years earlier?
My God. It's amazing how beautiful she was in this movie.
Yeah,
this movie is full of attractive people. You got Val Kilmer kind of, like, at his peak before...
his poutiest before he
goes before he goes to MacGruber era, you know, before... Although he was still a pretty good-looking man in Isle of Dr. Moreau. You know something about Val Kilmer? Val Kilmer's got a Reddit account, and he does fairly regular IMAs, and he is one of the most consistently charming and entertaining AMA guys.
Huh.
Because he fully owns, like, yeah, I was a young, stupid kid, and I pissed away a lot of chances I had, and I could have, but, like, I also got to work with Marlon Brando, and I've got, like, all these crazy, like, you think this the filming of The Isle of Dr. Moreau is crazy? Yeah, you didn't fucking live it. Oh, you saw the documentary? I was there. Like, he's...
Got some stories.
I really like him. He seems like a pretty genuine, happy, grounded dude, and at this point in his life, a decent father and friend. I don't know.
What has he done lately as far as, MacGruber. Like, film? Really? That was the last thing? Oh, man. MacGruber.
I don't know. Probably not. He's probably done other stuff. He's
Let
done
me
the
type
Saint.
In Val Kilmer.
You haven't seen The Saint 3, 4, 2, 2, 3, 4, and 5, the direct-to-video versions of The Saint?
I have not.
Where it's still Val Kilmer, but they kept on recasting Elizabeth Shue because she had standards.
That's actually nothing I've seen lately. He's been in Robot Chicken, but who hasn't?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But no, I felt like that's one of the false notes in the movie, the relationship between him and Ashley Judd, or at least the way I was perfectly happy with it until she waved him off. Because I also don't know, what did that do emotionally to the movie? Did that give Robert De Niro's character a victory? Because him dying on his own terms, I thought, was his victory.
Sure.
We are supposed to understand that as committed as he was to 80... Amy Brenneman, she was still in the category of when the heat was around the corner, he was gone in 30 seconds.
Yep.
So, you know, that was a really cool scene because they have this extended moment of eye contact where they're both coming to this. They're both kind of surprised at the conclusion that's being arrived at.
Yeah, it was. It was surprisingly, I didn't want that to happen. Like, yeah. It's irrational. Like, this relationship is not a thing that's going to work for either of them long term.
No.
I can just tell, looking at it. But I didn't want him to abandon her right there because she felt vulnerable in that position to me, and I felt like it was a really shitty thing to do.
But probably best thing that ever happened to her in retrospect.
Yes, yeah.
But no, I got it. Like, I couldn't believe how bummed out I was when, and I knew he died. Like, that's like, I couldn't forget. I knew who lived and who died, and I actually surprisingly remembered the final shootout and the cat and mouse game between those concrete barriers or dividers and fucking power boxes, whatever they are. But I was like super bummed out when he decided to whip off he had made it. He was safe. And then John Voight calls and he got to make the detour to get Mangrove or whatever. I was really bummed out.
Let me ask you this. Did you ever question whether John Voight was actually going to get him out of there?
I actually thought that I had a lot of thoughts in the second half of the movie that maybe John Voight had been compromised. And we're going to find out that he's actually working for Pacino. When he hung up after giving the mangrove, I thought that they're going to pull back the camera and Pacino's sitting in the bar with him or something.
I almost think he might have been. Like, the word on the street was put out there by the cops. John Voight's got to know that.
Yeah.
Like, where'd you hear this from?
Right.
Oh, it's a CI that I know.
Are we supposed to understand?
I'm not going to fucking believe it then.
Are we supposed to understand that Pacino's good enough that he's can get that out in a way that...
I don't know.
Because that's the thing. You just have to understand that both these guys are, like, at the top of their game.
Yeah. But he was broadcasting it. Like, it's not like he slipped it out to one critical person in the chain. He was like, get it out to every hen house, outhouse, doghouse in the county.
Tommy Lee Jones did. Yeah.
He did. And to me, like, John Voight would have sniffed that out in a moment. So I do think John Voight was compromised at the end, which to me says there was never an out for Robert De Niro.
Yeah. I want to talk about Tom Sizemore. Sizemore seems like a piece of work as an individual. But he's really good at playing, like, approachable, ferocious people. Like, he is able to convince me that he is a man who loves his daughter, and he is a guy who is afraid but's going to try to do right by his friends. He's also the guy that, with a single pointed glance, can make a pretty tough guy back the fuck down. Like, that scene in the bar where De Niro slams Mangrove's face into the pancakes and the big beefy guy, like, looks up from his paper and Tom Sizemore just, like, locks eyes and the guy's like, no.
He's got a little bit of, like, Michael Madsen in him. When I think of the two guys, I think they're kind of linked in their performances.
That's a really good comparison. Because he can be friendly and like, eh, it's a guy I can get a beer with. And then it's like, oh, shit, I got the beer with the wrong guy.
And he's cutting my ear off. Suddenly, like, I could see Tom Sizemore in that scene.
Yeah, he's stabbing someone and throwing him in the trunk. What have I gotten myself into? Yeah. He's really good in this film. He's really good in this film.
He is.
I almost want to kind of roll down the cast and just
talk
about
them
all.
We haven't talked about, like, the biggest neck in Hollywood, Henry Rollins. kind of a doughier performance, right? Like, he's always been a big guy.
Yeah, no, I obviously recognized him, but
he's gotten much more ripped, I will guess, in his old age.
Yeah, he's really bloaty in this. Okay, let's go down the list. Natalie Portman. When did The Professional come out?
It was before this, wasn't it?
It came out the year before. So you put that performance and this performance together, and you know, you're clear you're talking about someone who's got a fucking metric fuck ton of talent.
Yeah.
But she's kind of, I don't know that they used her effectively, because she didn't really feel like a fleshed out character. She felt like a human MacGuffin that was just going to give Pacino that much more pathos.
Yeah, there's so much going on in this movie. I feel like they could have dropped the whole Natalie Portman storyline.
Right.
And I would have been okay with that. I think, like, especially her suicide attempt comes kind of out of nowhere for me.
Right.
Like, I know she had problems with her real dad.
She's written to make Pacino's wife less likable, because, again, you know, however, you know, she deals with Pacino's bullshit in the way she deals with it. That's fine. But when you throw in a troubled youth in the middle of this marriage, like, it makes her Justine character a little bit less sympathetic, which I don't know that you needed to make the women characters in this movie less sympathetic, to be honest.
Sure.
We talk about John Voight. We talk about Tom Sizemore. Danny Trejo.
Yeah.
Good early work from Danny Trejo. Mm-hmm. Like, he plays a Danny Trejo type character really well.
he's great at playing those Danny Trejo type characters.
He is. He's really great.
Surprising.
We talked about Michael T. Williamson, who I first noticed in season 3 of Justified, where he played Limehouse. I mean, he's recognizably this guy, but he's also got a little bit of that, like, you know, he's got, who was it?
He's the LA version of Limehouse.
Yeah.
He's got
Hank Azaria. He's able to stop his bullshit with a pointed look. He's got a little bit of Tom Sizemore in him.
Yeah, I mean, seeing this performance from Michael T. Williamson makes me appreciate the work he was doing as Limehouse a lot more.
Right.
Because they're very different characters.
He wasn't allowed to really fully play his instrument in this movie.
No.
Yeah, he's a deep voice and a level head and an intimidating presence, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Ted Levine, Buffalo Bill as Bosco.
Right.
When I saw Ted, because the credits, it's one of the rare, like, all the stars, like, appear in the credits before the movie, and I'm like, I started just, like, freaking the fuck out. I'm like, Ted Levine is in this?
Right.
And when Mangrove showed up, I'm like, is that? But then he shows up, he's a good guy. I thought he was amazing.
He's good.
Yep. I've really started appreciating Ted Levine in his career of late. Like, he really I thought he was amazing in The Bridge. I saw him in, when did we watch Silence of the Lambs? Because I'd never seen Silence of the Lambs when I finally saw it for a commissioned podcast.
Like, at least a year ago.
2-3 years ago.
Yeah.
William Fichtner.
Yes, who, I really like William Fichtner. I don't know why.
Yeah.
His performances are never stellar, but it's always serviceable, and he's a really good character actor.
My headcanon says that he survived this gun attack and became the mobster banker in The Dark Knight.
Okay, sure.
Wes Studi, who is the Native American actor to play the detective, I thought was really good. But again, all these detectives that are underneath Pacino are kind of just archetypes.
Yeah.
President, what was his name in 24? President Palmer, Dennis Haysbert. probably the most tragic character in the movie.
I thought that was him, but I wasn't sure until you said it. Okay.
Yeah, he's probably the most tragic character in the whole movie because he's this ex-con. He's trying to do right, and it just shows how worked over these ex-cons can be in like these hopeless situations, and then...
And how that feeds back into their lives, you know?
Right. I really felt bad for him, and I really, like, it's a very underrated moment, but they have his sweetheart at a bar watching the news and seeing his face coming. Like, last she knew, he was working a shit job at the grill, and now he's dead.
Yeah.
Understated moment, but pretty fucking cool. Hank Azaria is just, like, you know, whatever. We're now, Jeremy Piven, what do you think of Jeremy Piven as Dr. Bob?
From fucking Stealth Piven.
Yeah.
Like, he's not in the credits in the beginning.
Right.
So I didn't know he was in this. And when he showed up, it just blew my mind. He was fine.
No, yeah. I mean, like I said, this has got a pretty fucking deep cast. So I definitely want to go through that. We did that. What else we want to talk about?
I knew as soon as, like, they started saying slick over and over again that was going to be the important thing in the movie. And
right.
It was, though not as important as I expected,
right.
I guess.
Did you think, like, the other thing is, during the heist where they're trying to steal, was it platinum? They're trying to steal something. And one of the cops, like, stumbles and bangs his gun against the side of a package car.
Mm-hmm.
And De Niro freezes, and they got that great scene where he's, like, staring right at Pacino through the infrared, and he calls it off. Like, am I supposed to believe that De Niro's that skittish? Like, go stand out on a random street corner some night at 3 o'clock in the morning and notice how many random bangs and scuffles and wind blow. Like,
it's because the cops are always watching.
Probably. It's probably why I never get in trouble at 3 a.m. because just when I'm about to do something skeevy, like, I hear the sound and I go scurry away like a De Niro. Did you buy that? Because I had a little bit of, like, really?
I guess you got to be, because, I mean, it feeds back into that you got to hit 100% of the shots you take. You know, like, if he doesn't, I bet he has called off many jobs that didn't need to be called off for this very same reason. Like, he could have gotten away very easily and no one was watching him, but he heard something weird and he said it's off.
I wish that maybe they're trying to suggest something with the way the box trucks were arranged, that was like, you know, oh, this is standard LAPD. Like, I don't know, but, like, I felt like if that was really, like, he would never get a job done.
Yeah.
But then again, I guess he'd never go to jail, too. So what else did I want to talk about? We already talked about the scene where Pacino squared off with De Niro. I was hoping that we would have the opposite conclusion because that's the most interesting possibility, right?
Did they have this meeting? So it wasn't at the behest of De Niro, so it couldn't have been. But I got the feeling that they dumped all the surveillance while this meeting was happening, I think, and then De Niro disappears as well.
Right.
I almost got the feeling that it was set up by De Niro to kind of distract the main guy here, the really sharp guy.
I think it was just timing, because there's no, like...
Like, just fortunate or unfortunate.
No, the, like,
timing,
De Niro's
whatever.
Crew was planning to do this dissolve into the night routine, and it just happens that Pacino got De Niro. Because I think that's the other thing, is, like, Pacino is growing frustrated with his men's inability to tail De Niro.
Yeah.
He's the wiliest guy. Every time at night, he somehow loses him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about to call bullshit, because he was having a meeting with John Voight, and I'm like, well, the movie's over. Pacino's going to know that you're having this meeting. He's going to see there. But then they quickly establish that, oh, yeah, you know, you keep losing him at night and you're confounding him. So I think Pacino's like, you know, fuck this. I'm going to personally follow him. I got nothing to hold on him. I'm just going to invite him to coffee, which set up the amazing scene. But, yeah, I think it was just coincidental.
Okay.
We haven't really talked about the gunfight in the middle of the streets.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that. It's...
It's so long, but it's also riveting.
So I remember vaguely when this actual thing, like, kind of thing happened in LA.
1997 in North Hollywood.
Right. And there was this extended, drawn-out shooting, like, back and forth between
11 cops
these heavily armed robbers and these cops. And it's kind of around the time where it was like, oh, should cops have assault rifles and all these kind of things?
That's one of the reasons why cops do have now, because they were faced with a class of criminal that they were totally unable to do anything to. Yeah. They were strapped with like level 3 body armor.
Yeah, their pistols just weren't.
That's a PUBG term. I don't know what you call it, but they had the good shit head to toe. Their like legs and arms and everything, and the cops couldn't shoot. It wouldn't penetrate.
No, and I feel like that was a huge crazy thing that happened in our real world.
Right.
And this movie obviously came before that, but
a lot of people say it was a copycat or inspired by.
They feel akin, certainly. But I look at this shootout in this movie and I go, this feels tame in a world like this. Shootout feels tame in a weird way, because in a world where there is a school shooting every other week, every other day.
Now we've become numb to it for sure.
Like, yeah, I it loses its impact, and it was surprising to me, like seeing myself watching this movie going, yeah, this is just another shootout. Which was kind of fucked up.
Yeah, no, like any random neighborhood across America, you could hear this. And I kept thinking the same thing, because the fact that civilians were in the middle of it is one of the points.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the how kind of like, that's where the line between police and I guess criminal gets blurry, because Pacino is not interested so much in law enforcement as he is the adrenaline rush of taking these guys down.
Yeah.
And they make a very effective point throughout the movie that these guys are the different sides of the same coin. Like, if Pacino hadn't gone, like, you know, he's got the Marine Corps background. He grew up in a law and order kind of thing, and was able to find an outlet for his rage and misanthropy in a way that De Niro's character didn't. But I felt like that, like, when they're opening fire, like, I would love to know the civilians' fatalities, but like, it's, yeah, like I was seeing people running and screaming and shrieking. You can't in 2018 help but draw conclusions between the stuff that we see literally every other week.
Right.
And this isn't like, again, like, you know, in 1995, it's like this big thing over a bank. In 2018, it's literally a suburban school.
Yeah.
You know, the crazy thing is, so I just spent, I actually was in I spent the weekend coincidentally in the neighborhood that got shot up. Not the neighborhood, but less than an hour away.
Hmm.
Do you know how many people I heard having conversations about that?
Zero.
Zero.
Wow.
I was in a fairly conservative retirement park for the most part, but like, I cannot believe that this happens less than an hour away and people were in complete fucking denial about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was interesting. What else we want to talk about? Oh, Danny Trejo's death, man. Like, mm-hmm. I thought when he started talking, I was actually surprised. I thought De Niro was just talking to a corpse, like asking rhetorical questions. And when Trejo started croaking out words, I'm like, what? This is some fucking Seven shit.
Yeah. He was pressing the lungs out of his air, or the lungs out of his air, the air out of his lungs. And those were just the words that were on his lips.
Yeah.
When he died.
Yeah.
It's like looking at what somebody saw the moment they died.
I guess I was a little bit dismissive in Natalie Portman's performance, but I wrote in my notes that, like, she does give a pretty physically great performance when Pacino fishes her out of the tub. Like, she's just a boned fish.
Yeah.
Her legs bend in all kinds of unnatural directions as Pacino's cradling her and doing all that. And she's just like, she seems like a corpse. I feel like that's an underrated thing. That's an underrated hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
To, like, you know, just go limp like that and give good dead person. I've seen people do bad dead person.
I did have a hard time, I guess, buying this Amy Brenneman Robert De Niro romance.
You did?
Not in the same ways that you did, I think. Or the same issues that you brought up, but I just think it was a little sudden. It was surprising to me that a guy who was so on point with his you know, anything you can't walk out in 30 seconds would say, I'm on my last job, oh, and I'm also going to get involved in a relationship. Like, to me, that guy should have said, I'm on my last job, I'm not going to get involved in a relationship, I'll pick something up in New Zealand.
Right.
Like, once the job is done, once I'm out.
But Amy Brenneman had a great ass, and De Niro's head was way up in it. I mean, I think, because I was about to say, like, one of the weaknesses, because I said the opposite. I felt like there was the most believable relationship, but their meet cute, it did feel kind of random. Like, why? I mean, yeah, Amy Brenneman is a very good looking woman, but what? Like, I felt like something like De Niro would need, there'd have to be a hook there.
Yeah, I would have thought.
And what was the hook? And it wasn't, I didn't get it.
Here's the unfortunate thing, is I think you can both say it was the best relationship in the movie and also still pretty bad.
Right. And I don't think the movie would even, like, I don't know that Michael Mann would argue. Like, I don't know what Michael Mann thinks about his heroes. Whether, like, these are, like, animals that we need to have on our walls to protect us, whether, like, this is the human, like, it's the necessarily human cost to having these kind of driven individuals, whether they're, like, you know, cautionary tales that, you know, we shouldn't have to be like this. I don't know. But I feel like at no point in the movie was there a conscious effort to actually defend this behavior or to glorify it, although the end result, I do agree, does glorify it.
Sure, but like, as it relates to De Niro and Brenneman's relationship in this movie, I don't think it's surprising to me that it wasn't even like a factor in the finality, the climax of this movie. Like, yes, it was on the screen, but it had no relation to De Niro getting caught whatsoever. It was ultimately like his desire to kill this guy who had fucked him that brought him down. It had nothing to do with his relationship.
I guess it just heightened the tragedy because, like, you got this guy who's never formed attachments.
It does, yeah.
But the end of the movie does, because, like, did he form an attachment because he left her in 30 seconds?
Right.
So, like, it's... But to me, I guess that was pretty interesting. Like, I feel like the way De Niro played that is it was as much a surprise to him as anyone that, like, well, shit, I guess this is what I am going to do. I guess I didn't care. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
I mean, how long does that last? Does that last? What if he stays in America and he stays doing his thing? Does Amy Brenneman become something that he can't walk out on in 30 seconds?
I don't know.
Or is, I guess it's a fair question. Like, is he not quite to that point, but sees that it could eventually happen? And so he says, I'm not going to get attached so much that I can't walk away during this final job. But once he's in New Zealand, he might. He's just like getting a head start on the New Zealand stuff.
I don't know. I don't know. It would be, it kind of like, I don't know how you do it because the movie's already too long, but I felt like maybe I needed to see another one of Robert De Niro's relationships to contrast, to see whether, because, you know, here's the thing that the movie encourages you to forget a lot of points to identify and empathize with Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro is the kind of guy where one of his loose cannons kills a cop, a security guard for no real reason. And he then kills two other dudes who are completely innocent and working stiffs just to protect himself. Mm-hmm. He's a bad guy. It's entirely possible that you're right. Like, he was just hitting Amy Brenneman because he needed a physical release for himself. And he never really cared about her until he was thinking of his retirement. And I like her.
Like, this would be a nice person to bring with me into retirement, but I'm not quite retired yet.
But to me, his relationship with her felt very adolescent. And maybe that's one of the points in the movie, is that this guy has not had, because whether you're a 40-year-old virgin or a 17-year-old virgin, I feel like you need to get a certain amount of reps in relationships before you know what the fuck you're doing. Yeah. Some people get lucky and that they, you know, they meet up with a person when they're young and they fall in love, and then they change as people, but they change in complimentary ways. And those are the ones everybody, oh, they've been married 65 years and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Everybody else just kind of bumblefucks around until they find out what they like and what they need and what they can put up with, and they need to grow as a person, and they're finally ready. I felt like De Niro as a man has never done any of that. So mm-hmm. he's he fell in love like a high school freshman. He conducted relationship and put her on a pedestal and like, oh, I need everything. I know everything I need to know. Like maybe that's one of the lines, is he's just got a very immature. Whereas Pacino knows better. He just is selfish. Like, I know that I can't make a marriage work. I'm going to try this time. I'm not going to make her any promises, but I still know I shouldn't be in a relationship. I'm going to get in one anyway, and I'm paying the price for it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the things I think this movie is kind of deep and rewards multiple viewings, because you can kind of go in and do character studies on individual aspects of these guys and relationships and, I don't know, theorize yourself what's fucked up and what's not.
Yeah.
I don't know how rewarding that is, but that's also a really fun movie to watch.
It's true.
But yeah, I mean, guys, I feel like the other thing, we really haven't talked about the look and feel of the movie. Like, Michael Mann is essentially an immensely rich man's version of Michael Bay.
Okay. He's the De Niro to Al Pacino.
Like what is Mike?
To Michael Bay's Al Pacino. Like when Michael Bay goes shouting at the camera,
right?
Got great ass!
Right.
He's there to say, no, let's bring it down a notch,
right?
In their directing styles.
Like Michael Bay's best film, which I think is probably The Rock.
Okay, that's a good pick.
Is as good as Michael Mann's worst film, which might be Miami Vice.
I haven't seen a lot of his
but
stuff.
But like, it's like where the ceiling of Michael Bay is the floor of Michael Mann.
Huh.
Because in a Michael Bay film, none of this, we wouldn't be having these complicated discussions about the characters and their, like, you know, that they're like, and ultimately they're silly and they're dysfunctional, but there's pathos, there's like Shakespearean, you know, like De Niro, Pacino, or Romeo and Juliet, man.
Yeah,
they
pretty
fucking
much
are. And that stuff just, you don't get in a Michael Bay film.
Yeah.
In favor of explosions and, you know, Transformers getting their heads ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to have, like, him and Ridley Scott. They're the thinking man's action movie makers. I guess James Cameron, you could throw that in there, too. Some guys elevate it. Some, like, this is an action flick. This is a crime thriller, but it's like, you know, best in show. I don't really have a lot. I thought maybe we should go to Freddie C.
Yeah.
And get his feedback on it. Freddie C says, here's a movie that I'm positive would eventually get commissioned one day, and I'm lucky to be the one to do it. It's easily one of my favorite movies. Has great dialogue, awesome characters, one of the best shootouts in film history. Funny thing is, Heat is one of those few films that not only has a fantastic cast, but also an on-paper shitty cast as well. So sure, you've got Pacino, De Niro, not fat Val Kilmer, John Voight, Natalie Portman, Ted Levine, Ashley Judd.
Yeah.
But if I told you the best heist movie ever made featured speaking roles from the singer of Funky Cold Medina, a Def Comedy Jam regular, R.I.P. Ricky Harris, the lead singer of Black Flag, Jeremy Piven, and the most prominent voice actor on The Simpsons, you'd think I was crazy.
Hey, man, I've seen Ace Ventura at this point. I know that Tone Loke can bring it when it comes to acting.
Can you think of any other great dramatic movies that have a huge cast of unconventional dramatic actors?
Man, I was trying to brainstorm before the podcast. And
The thing that trips you up is great dramatic movies.
It does, yeah. Because like the closest thing I can come up with is Armageddon, which had like a surprisingly deep 90s cast of people who either later became huge stars or were like burgeoning stars at the time. But that's not a great movie.
I mean, you could go,
that's an entertaining movie.
You could go maybe, but then this thing, okay, so here's the thing.
Sure.
Who are
John Cusack. Like,
but here's the cast for Armageddon. Bruce Willis, Liv Tyler, Ben Affleck, Steve Buscemi, Billy Bob Thornton. Stop me when we get to Piven level.
Okay.
Michael Clark Duncan, Owen Wilson, William Fichtner, Jessica Steen, Peter Stormare.
Peter Stormare.
No, come on.
Peter Stormare
is Fargo.
Is a great character actor.
Yeah.
But he's a great character actor in, like, I'm not trying to place him in a character in this movie.
Maybe Ken Hudson. Ken Hudson is the fat guy in Groundhog Day that Bill Murray gives a pep talk to.
Okay, there you go.
You're getting to that level.
Yep. Now you're in Tone Loke level. The guy from Falling Skies.
Eddie Griffin apparently is in this movie that I've forgotten about. Like, I it's it's tougher because you don't, like, you don't have a half dozen of those guys. I was going to say, like, one of the Ocean's 11, maybe. The Ocean 11 cast, because, but there again, that's another one where, number one, I don't know, that's a great movie. It's a fun movie.
Right.
But, like, I can't, like, Bernie Mac, maybe? Casey Affleck, maybe. But Casey Affleck has morphed into a serious actor now.
Yeah, he was not at the time, though.
You know, Elliot Gould is a serious guy. Scott Caan, the son of Sonny Corleone. Carl Ryan. I mean, these guys, him. Eddie Jemison, maybe? Or that. I don't know, man. It's really tough. It's really tough. Because, like, I can think of lots of not great movies.
Yeah.
That have weird eclectic casts, like any of the, like, airplane style movies, any of the, you know, the scary movie things have, like, that kind of, but, like, a great film with a weird fusion kind of cast like that, that's a lot harder. I really
there's weird stuff, like, there are great movies that don't quite fit the, like, super deep cast of not that well known people, like Death to Smoochie. Is a great movie that has, like, a lot of big stars playing roles they don't traditionally play, but it doesn't have, like, those kind of B-list people bringing thunderous performances.
Yeah. And I guess the thing is, like, that's the key. They can't be just, like, jokes or stunt cast. It's got to be people that are in a work and they're not, and that is kind of like above them, and they're not like completely besmirching themselves, or they're perfectly cast. Like, I was thinking, another one is Schwarzenegger's spot. What was that? The true spot, True Lies. It's got Tom Arnold in it as, like, the co-star. That's fucking ridiculous.
He's punching above his weight there.
He's punching way above his, but that's one dude. That's one dude.
Right.
Like, Bill Paxton is in that movie, but Bill Paxton's a great, you know, late great Bill Paxton he's been in a lot of great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in a lot of genre work. Like, it's not, he doesn't not belong in that film.
Right.
Tom Arnold does not belong in True Lies. I don't know. That's one of the greatest questions we've been, posed, Freddie.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think I'd be remiss if I did not mention that Freddie C was a hero in our, in our recent, Groundhog's Day charity drive for the National Alliance in Homelessness. Dude chipped in one donation, and I'm pretty sure that this was not his only donation of the night. $1,600 to put us over the $10,000 mark, and he commissioned this movie Heat back in November of 2016. Man, thanks for all you do, Freddie. Thanks for all you've done for Bald Move, and thanks for your generosity and your support. And thanks for commissioning this movie, because I had a hell of a lot of fun watching it. It was such a treat to go home last night, put this thing on, and just have pure delight watching it for 3 hours, and now talking about it on the podcast.
And it's one of those movies that I knew that I should watch. Because it's a classic. Like,
right.
Everybody talks about Heat. And I thought maybe I had watched it. I confused it with The Score, which has Robert De Niro and Ed Norton.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, that's a great movie. I love that movie.
Right.
No, a totally different movie.
Yeah, it's another one of those. That's one of the great things about the commission podcast is sometimes you get one of those dusty wine bottles that's been sitting on the shelf, and like the, you know, There Will Be Bloods and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But no, thank you for all that you've done. Freddie, I hope you enjoyed this commission review. Unfortunately, again, we are still way far behind in our commission tab, commission queue, and we are not prepared to open it to new commissions yet. We have a couple of good ones coming up. We've got The Exorcist, Highlander, It Follows. Lots of good stuff that's coming out the commission queue. And we'll be back with the next one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.